historical research in an online world, a roundtable discussion on the impact of digital technologies on the future of historical scholarship. And we team up with Jan Oosthuyck from the Exploring Environmental History podcast to explore his work on the web. I'm Sean Courage, and this is Episode 10 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. The Network in Canadian History and Environment Digital Infrastructure Group, led by Professor William Turkell from the University of Western Ontario, hosted a two-day workshop on Application Programming Interfaces for the Humanities. I attended the workshop in Mississauga, Ontario, and had the chance to meet with many leading scholars in the area of digital humanities. On this episode of the podcast, we look at the impact of digital technologies on historical research, and specifically, the work of environmental historians. Online-based application programming interfaces, or APIs, are just one digital technology that holds the potential to change the way environmental historians access resources, analyze historical data, and communicate research findings. Within the past decade alone, the development of online digital technologies has offered the potential to transform historical scholarship. While I was at the API workshop, I decided to sit down with some of the participants to discuss their thoughts on the future impacts of digital technologies on historical research. So I'm here speaking with some luminaries in the field of digital history who are going to give us some insights into digital technologies that have changed or will change the way that historians do research or disseminate their research. So why don't we go around the table and just introduce ourselves.
Hi, I'm Dan Cohen. I'm an associate professor of history at George Mason University and the director of the Center for History and New Media, which produces a bunch of websites and software, some of which I'll talk about on this podcast.
My name is Shekhar Krishnan. I'm a PhD student in the program in Science, Technology, and Society at MIT, which is a history anthropology program. I also work with a software consultancy called Entropy Free, and we do work for the New York Public Library.
Hi, my name is John Lutz. I teach history at the University of Victoria in Victoria, British Columbia, and I'm a co-director of the Great Unsolved Mysteries in Canadian History Project, and have a bunch of other website and history, digital history projects on the go.
Great. So, Dan, why don't you kick us off here? Digital technologies that you think have or will change the way that historians research or communicate the research?
Sure. Well, I guess I always like to break down this question into a few different areas, because sometimes we talk about historical research or digital history in a broad way, and I think there's a few things that we're really talking about. One is research as the process of discovery and finding things that you might want to look at further. There's a second phase of what I guess we'd broadly call analysis, where you would then take what you found in phase one and subject those to certain processes, and we already do that obviously with books, and I'm not talking about just digital history here. And then there's a third piece, which is the communication of the results of that research. And I think digital technology has potential in all of these realms. It's kind of farther ahead or behind, depending on which segment you look at. I think that there are pieces that we're working on in each of these areas at the center. So we have in the first phase a lot of new kinds of digital collections. Some of them are of born digital materials, like the September 11th Digital Archive, where we're trying to make materials available in a kind of maximally useful way. We're taking advantage of the digital technology to not only display, but make those things available for analysis using digital methods. And the second phase, the research phase, we have projects like Zotero, which your audience might have heard about, which is software that runs in the browser that allows individual researchers and now groups with Zotero 2.0 to collect digital objects and then subject them to research methods, some of which are related to social media and some of which might in the future be related to things like text mining. And I think that that's an area which right now is kind of underexplored. I think there's some terrific projects out there like the Tepor project in Canada that has a great array of tools. And what we're trying to do is marshal the resources from that phase one of digital history to pass off as a package to analysis services such as text mining or visualization services. In the third area, I'm really interested in new forms of scholarly communication. I think they mostly revolve around new modes of open access, presentation and discussion, the center, we have a lot of active bloggers and tweeters and wiki makers and things like that. And I think there's a lot to be done in that area. I've always felt like, you know, what we do as historians should be open and widely available. And I think there's a lot of things we can do on that side of the digital history equation as well.
Okay. John, your thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Dan, and I think there's another area, there's a fourth area too we could think about, which is teaching, because the web has changed the way we can and maybe should behave as teachers, partly because the resources that Dan has talked about are more and more available to us now. So students, I think in the past we used to teach history by telling students what happened, and now we can actually turn students into historians and have them go to raw materials of history and find out for what happened. So I think that's really exciting, and the new kinds of presentations that Dan mentioned, you know, they're both for teachers and for researchers to get our historical work out to a vast audience that we never could access before. Mm-hmm. I think increasingly people are not getting their history from text, and they're not getting their history from, you know, the kind of books we write. They're getting their history from Wikipedia and from different parts of the web, and if as historians we're not there, were less and less useful to society. So,
Shager, do you agree?
I do agree. I mean, that sort of last point that you made, I mean, it's sort of what's happened with the web, and we've been having discussions about this at the workshop over the past couple of days, is, you know, there's been this kind of flattening of the playing field in some ways in terms of the resources that people are putting out there, whether it's on Wikipedia or Flickr or, you know, any of these sort of new Web 2.0 linked data type of sites and APIs, and now the stakes have risen for historians in terms of what they're going to do with this incredible explosion of data that's out there. I mean, I like the way that Dan sort of broke it up into, you know, sort of resources, analysis, and presentation. I think what's really interesting about some of the other things we've been talking about, particularly related to maps as a new form of data that's now available on the web for the first time in fairly high resolution and available to manipulate in ways that we couldn't do before. I mean, the past 5 to 10 years, people have been madly digitizing everything that they can get their hands on. But the question still arises then that once we've got a digital archive, what can we do with it? And that's where analysis, interpretation, sort of these more sophisticated tools that get into the real, what, you know, in a sense, where the rubber hits the road as far as digital history is concerned, would be that how do these things potentially transform the acts of storytelling, narrative formation, sort of methodologies of thinking about, say, for instance, the space of a city or the space of a region or, you know, the urban environment or something like that. So I've been working on some small project right now with Niche to do a little mapping of the Yukon River Valley in relation to the Klondike Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to put together, again, through different types of linked data services, including Zotero 2.0 and the Zotero API, to have a shared bibliography, say, about the Klondike Gold Rush and what sources are available, you know, in different catalogs all over the place, a set of photographs that are geotagged in Flickr, and then a bunch of map layers that we have for the historical, you know, region of the Yukon River Valley, and be able to look at them over time. And it's actually, you know, research is essentially the process of being able to make new and imaginative connections, particularly, you know, for the historian who's there. Whole field is really, you know, they're using their imagination to connect disparate sources. And the web that's now playing into that, you know, the sort of the research web that's emerging of how we can connect these discrete data sources. I mean, I'm not really sure what kinds of new historical questions and stories it's going to open up. So I do think it's really exciting. Yeah,
so do you foresee scholarship changing in a way? What would the dissertation look like?
That's where I think less of the change has happened. And that's where I think...
Right.
Pressure may be building up for some change.
Well, you know, I alternate between being an optimist and a pessimist about this stuff. You know, with technology, in the technology world, the pace of change is very fast, and so I have one foot in that world, but the other foot's firmly in academia, which is a very medieval sort of place with a lot of inertia, and the dissertation is one of those areas that's going to be difficult to change. You know, I do think that it's important to address these, you know, resistance in among traditional academics about each of these phases. And there's kind of mythologies that exist about each of these things, including about the dissertation, actually, as a kind of, you know, the gold standard or some kind of form that's that's perfect that needs to be addressed. And so when I look at, again, each of these three phases that I talked about, and I think it's great that John added teaching in there because a fourth phase, you know, there is significant resistance that I think is important to kind of eat at. And I think, so just sticking with, let's say, the MAPS question, I think MAPS is one of these great areas where it has immediate positive benefits. So you could show to a historian something, and it moves beyond, if done right, just simply how quickly you're able to put together, let's say, a very sophisticated map, which, after all, historians have used maps since the Greeks. So I think that that's something that people have done. Yeah. But, you know, there is a phase where it's just a quantitative difference of, wow, I've got a giant archive, and it would take me 2 months, but I could plot all this stuff on a map if I read through all these letters, and came up with the place names, and put them there. There's that moment of, wow, this takes me 5 seconds using the New York Public Library Maps tool. Yeah. But then there's a second phase, which I think is really critical to get beyond the resistance, which is it's allowing me to ask and answer new questions. And I think we're in a really exciting phase right now. I wish I was a graduate student right now. I think there's work to be done to say, here's a new digital form that actually has a thesis to it, that says something new about a particular time or place. And I think that's what's really exciting, when we have examples like that. And to be honest, as an attempt at self-criticism in digital history, we have not had a lot of those examples.
We're getting there, yeah.
Yeah, but I think we're at the point now where the tools, the openness of the collections, possibilities for teaching are kind of emerging, where you could imagine fairly sophisticated uses that aren't just uses of technology for technology's sake, but actually get to the point of better learning, better scholarship, all the things that we've been trying to do all along.
Do you think these technologies have the potential to change expectations of historical scholarship with digital resources expanding in terms of, let's say, for instance, the scanning of newspaper records? If more and more records are available, are the expectations going to change of what a historian should be looking at because of the ease at which you can now access these resources?
I think the standards are going up, and probably going up pretty fast. I mean, that's the scary part about being a graduate student today, is you have to keep up with all of the new material that's available. And I guess the university is a conservative place, and it's going to take a long time to change. But academic publishing is in disarray at the moment, as people try and figure out how to keep university presses alive, because the monograph is not thriving. And so I think, as historians, we're going to have to figure out a new way to take the information which is in a monograph and doesn't fit nicely on the web. The monograph doesn't map well onto the web, but it's important what we do in a monograph, and we have to figure out a way to repackage that for the web. And I think the dissertation is going to follow as we figure out that, monograph is not the gold standard anymore, or maybe it's only one of the gold standards. I don't think the monograph should disappear.
What are the other potential communication technologies that might allow historians to move beyond monographs or journal articles that you guys have seen?
I've been blogging for many years, and a lot of us at the Center for History and the Media have been blogging. I often, say to people, if you just don't consider it to be a blog, which has this baggage of what a blog is, that it's about what you ate for breakfast this morning, if you consider it instead a personal publishing website, well, you can choose to make a personal publishing website whatever you choose to make it. If you want to make it about your breakfast, that's one thing. I feel, as an academic, I have a, probably rather staid blog that's, is pretty, I use humor more than I do, let's say, in my published articles, but it's still something that I consider to be scholarly production. And I think it's just a matter of perspective on it. If you take that perspective, I think if I were a graduate student right now, and I've counseled lots of graduate students about this, I think one of the best things you could do is start a really good blog. Yeah. It's actually how I found most of the people at this conference, is through open access self-publishing, quote unquote, blog. I think it's really, if we want to be narcissistic about it, the best thing you can do for your reputation. I think it's better than publishing an article in some no-name journal just because it's quote-unquote peer-reviewed. Bill Turkel, I found his stuff immediately because I subscribe to all of the digital history blogs I can find. And as soon as Bill started blogging, I knew this was a superstar in the field, and I told lots of people about Bill's work. And I continue to be impressed by Bill's work, even though he's no longer blogging. So he's moved on to other pastors. But
R.I.P. Digital History Hacks.
Right.
It was a great blog.
But even as that, I mean, in the same way, as sometimes you don't write forever on a particular topic. And so I thought it's fine to have a blog that might last 2 or 3 years that's on a specific topic as Bill's was. So I think if you're a grad student, it's a great time to do stuff in a blog. I actually think Twitter, in a former life, I was a historian of religion as well, and I'm a firm believer in William James's premise that you look at the fruits, not the roots. And so I think Twitter, you look at the roots, it seems like what could you ever do in 140 characters with silly handles for names? But it turns out when you get involved with it pretty seriously, it simulates the feel of an academic community if you do it right. And I think there's some professors that I point people to who are good to emulate if you're a grad student, like Jay Rosen, the journalism professor at NYU, who uses Twitter as a kind of ongoing live seminar with his audience, which is now 27,000 people, which is a lot more than most professors will talk to in the entirety of their life. So I think that again, if you approach each of these technologies with the eye toward, you know, what can it do if you know, you emulate certain standards, I think it's all very useful.
Do you think that these alternative digital forms of communicating historical research need formalization to get credit in academia, or is the strength of them the informal nature of a blog or a Twitter post?
Well, as a graduate student who recently had a meeting with my director of graduate studies about a week ago, where I sort of told him about this, that, you know, I have a bit of a dilemma that on the one hand I'm doing sort of somewhat old-fashioned social history thesis dissertation on colonial Bombay on the one hand, and on the other hand I've been developing these, you know, really cool mapping bibliographic gazetteer tools to actually do better research with, but I haven't actually really applied it to my own research just yet, and I would need that extra additional time that's required to experiment and see if this thing is there. And no, actually, the answer is that in most programs they don't encourage this type of experimentation yet. It's certainly not incentivized in the way that, for instance, presenting papers at, you know, fairly stuffy academic conferences, papers which will then become chapters of your eventual dissertation, of your eventual monograph that's eventually to be published by an academic press that's in crisis right now. So it's, you know, we're not incentivized at all. And in fact, I've had to lead a kind of a double existence as a digital historian, which now, thanks to Zotero, you know, the director of my program a couple of months ago came to me and sort of confessed that he was a Zotero addict. And I was like, that's great. You know, so there is this now kind of increasing awareness amongst faculty and administrators that this is there. But, you know, the dissertation as a form of publication and validation within the academy, you know, it goes back to the 18th century, I think. So, you know, there is this sort of, you know, sort of slightly sclerotic relationship with technology in academia.
I think historians and humanists generally have been hostile to new technologies. We're a conservative lot by nature, and so unlike other faculties around the university where technology is embraced a lot more quickly, we have to push the wheel uphill a little bit steeper, I guess, hill than our colleagues. But I think, back to your question, I do think we have to systematize, at least in the current system, some ways of validating different kinds of intellectual work that is digital, whether it's creating APIs, as we're talking about here this weekend, or blogs or wikis or anything. I mean, each of those needs to be fit somewhere in our hierarchy of sort of academic contributions, scholarly and public contributions, in order for graduate students to get credit, for faculty members to get promotion.
Right. Where does your blog fit on your CV?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, what I'd like to say on this, just one point on it, is people who participate in this world, in the digital history world, and are participating in, you know, writing blogs, being on Twitter, et cetera, we all know every Friday at 5 p.m. what the most important things were that happened in digital history, whether that's in digital archives or analysis or scholarly communications or digital pedagogy. We know all that stuff every Friday at 5. And so something has happened out of these little pieces that, you know, you asked, does there need to be some formal aspect to it? And my answer is probably not. I mean, we kind of know what the important articles mm-hmm. or blog posts or books that were published that week were without having some formal journal that has the imprimatur of a scholarly society or a university press. Now, whether that can be transferred to other fields outside of digital history, where you don't have a lot of grad students and professors on Twitter, well, you know, that remains to be seen.
I also just wanted to say one thing, which maybe is also a slight self-correct or self-critique, which is that I think that we shouldn't portray historians, though they are, you know, academia is a conservative culture. I mean, historians do come with a great amount of technical skill and tacit knowledge that they've always brought to their practice, to their disciplinary practice, whether it's dealing with large archives with complicated internal structures or simply interpreting documents for which we have no implicit, you know, meaning available to us and we have to reconstruct it by context. So I think that the web in some places could be a very native form for a lot of historians to bring those skills in. And I don't think that, you know, digital history, you know, from the other side appears as a kind of de-skilling, you know, for mm-hmm. a lot of elder historians or more accomplished historians. It's just so much easier to find sources now. And, you know, simply the act of traveling halfway around the world to find one document that's going to make your narrative or break it is part of the great passion and, you know, quest of most historians. And digital history changes that game as well. It takes the adventure out in some ways. But so we have to find a way of bringing that back in, and also not neglecting the great, you know, I think Web 3.0 is going to be the return of print in some great new form, right? I think print, we've delegitimized print. Most of our archives are still in print. They're not digitized. They probably won't be, at least the archives that I work on, which are in India, and they don't even have an electronic card catalog right now. I'm sitting poring through massive rooms full of documents, and I am my own Google now, right? It's all up here. So, but everyone has that tacit knowledge they accumulate, which is never gonna just be tapped through some API, you know, in a machine-readable form. So, you know, I think that from the other side, a lot of historians who are skeptical of these things will use that as a defense that, you know, and they are technologists in their own way. So, anyway, I just wanted to...
I am my own Google. I think that's a good place to conclude the conversation, but obviously the conversation will continue down the road. Before we close out here, though, I want to give listeners a chance of where they can find each of you on the internet. If you want to drop your Twitter handle or a website address?
Sure. Dan Cohen, very easy to find, at Dan Cohen, DanCohen on Twitter, and dancohen.org on the web.
I'm on the web. I'm at heptanesia.net, heptanesia.net, and on Twitter, I'm Bombayologist.
And I'm found at canadianmysteries.ca and web /uvic/TildaJLutz. So
we'll have all of those up on the show notes. I want to thank everybody for participating in this discussion. It was really good.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Environmental historians who work online, many of whom listen to this podcast, will also be familiar with the work of Jan Oosthuyck, an environmental historian based out of the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Jan has been active in managing online environmental history resources for more than a decade, and is probably best known for his groundbreaking podcast, Exploring Environmental History. Jan attended the API workshop in Mississauga and joined us on Nature's Past to tell us more about his work and the potential of online resources for environmental historians and history education.
Okay, thanks, Sean, for having me on the podcast. I'm Jan Oosthuyck. I'm an environmental historian based at the University of Edinburgh, and I'm working there on creating a master program in environmental history, and it's an online program.
So a lot of our listeners may be familiar with who you are because of the different
online resources that you manage. You you manage websites including eh-resources.org and eh-teaching.org, and you are the producer and host of the Exploring Environmental History podcast. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how these web projects began, what were the origins of these projects, and what they offer for environmental historians who may be listening who aren't familiar with them.
Well, Environmental History Resources, the first website you mentioned, is the most important of these three projects. It's a general resource for environmental historians with a focus on, I must say, Europe. And there's a lot of stuff about Scotland because that's where a lot of my research is focused on. But I try to go beyond that. There are also bibliographies, for example, and there are bibliographies on topics which have a global significance, things like climate history, Australian history. But also there are teaching and learning resources which also have a global reach, because environmental history doesn't stop at borders.
Right.
So the kind of things that are there are essays, for example, and these are topics that interest me. So yes, some people say it's quite limited in terms of scope, but of course it's only one person writing them. What else is there? I have started to put up map material. Historical maps are very interesting for environmental historians because you can use them to track changes over time. So there's a whole range of things. I'm not going into all of them. I only can suggest that people visit the website.
Absolutely.
But how did it all start? It started way back in 1998, when I was in my second year of my PhD. And while surfing on the web a lot and trying to find material, which was much harder then than now, I realized there's not really an environmental history website. Yes, there's H Environment, but that's really attached to the list, to the discussion list. But there's not really a website. And the American Society of Environmental History was actually, their website was actually H Environment. The European Society for Environmental History didn't exist, so no website there. So I thought, there's a gap in the online.
Mm-hmm.
So I make my own website to present the work I'm doing. And I created a website, and over time it grew. And initially the name was Oosthoek's Environmental Home Site. And that ran until 2005. I stopped actually maintaining it actively in 2002 when I left the University of Stirling, mm-hmm. where it was based. It was hosted by the university, to go to Germany for a postdoc. And in 2005, the University of Stirling, they shut down the website. And then I decided to start again, completely from scratch. And in January 2006, I launched Environmental History Resources, which had a much broader remit than the website that existed before. I wanted to turn it more of a general resource. Environmental History of Teaching, eh-teaching.
The sister site.
Yeah, it's kind of sister site, but not, yeah, yes and no. It's the purpose of the site was to present material of two projects I'd done with students. One was a project looking at numeracy and teaching general environmental concepts to humanities students. And the second was a podcasting project with students, and the results have been put on this website. So anyone interested in, for example, doing podcasting with students, that's a good resource to go to. And the podcast, how did that come about? In 2006, I decided podcasting is an up-and-coming thing. Why not making an environmental history podcast and start to interview people working in the field?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a perfect way of disseminating research done within the environmental history community to the wider world, but also to create a student resource, as well as a resource for environmental historians themselves, and to hear what other people are doing. From there it grew into, I think, in the meantime, quite an established podcast, and it's It gets very positive reactions on it, and it's fun to do. It's really fun to do.
And listeners who can't get enough of Environmental History Podcast should certainly check out eh-resources.org, where they can find out information on how to access your podcast. They can download episodes directly there, subscribe to the podcast through various feeds, as well as access all of these different resources that you've put up over now more than 10 years.
Yes.
So do you think that the development of online-based resources for environmental historians has changed the way that you research or communicate your research?
Communicating, definitely, because it's so easy to put stuff online. Your own research or articles you've written, a lot of publishers now allow you, after a little while, to put the PDFs online. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely brilliant. So it means that you're making stuff available to people who had no access to it in the past. Also for myself, I find gems online, the complete databases there that when I started my PhD back in 1997, they were simply not available. Now they are. Spatial representation of material on Google Maps, even 5 years ago, unthinkable, fantastic. What we should do is actually put historical maps online. So all environmental historians out there, please try to do that. That's really valuable for any environmental historian, I think. The way we work in general, the first stop, I think, for any researcher nowadays is to go to the web and try to find articles related mm-hmm. to what they want to research. Also unthinkable about 10 years, 15 years ago. I think it changed the way we approach our research.
Now, in terms of communication, do you feel like disseminating your research online is working in two directions? Are you getting feedback from what you're posting?
I mainly get feedback on the podcast.
Right.
Is that informing my research? Yeah, sometimes it does, because it's especially the people I interview who sometimes come back afterwards and say, well, listening to the podcast and then the conversation we had there, I got some ideas out of that, and then it bounces back to me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it inspires me as well. I get some ideas out of it. For example, I did recently four podcasts on what is environmental history, and through these interviews I did with three scholars in the field, I got some ideas about, well, what is environmental history and what is its methodology I'd never thought about before. How do we work as environmental historians? And it actually cleared more my mind of what we are doing. I will definitely use in the future in my teaching as well as writing.
Well, let's talk about teaching and environmental history education a little bit then. You've been working on a new program, and I was hoping you could explain to listeners what the Masters of Science program in Landscape, Environment, and History is all about.
Yes, that's it's an online distance learning course which we are setting up at the University of Edinburgh, and the aim is to teach environmental history in the broadest sense, which means that there are modules on the environmental history of Scotland, because it's very much focused on Scotland, although our audience, our target audience is global. But yeah, you have to take an example. A module that's examining the environmental history of Scotland from the Ice Age up till the present day, and it's looking at how the landscape changed over time naturally, but also how people have used the landscape and altered the landscape and responded to changes that occurred in the environment or climate change. That's one module. Another module is looking at urban environmental history, because the urban environment mm-hmm. is also important. Most people live in an urban environment. Landscape archaeology is another thing that we're doing. And we try to integrate all these different modules and aspects of environmental history to show that the environment doesn't stop at the boundaries of a city, for example. And in terms of... Agata, you want to know something about the technologies that
sure,
we're using?
Sure, yeah.
The technologies that we're using are... Well, the course itself runs is written in XML, mm-hmm. and we're using style sheets to make it look good. The advantage of using XML is that you can easily generate, for example, reading lists at the end of a module, or plays videos inside very easily, embed them. Mm-hmm. We're using a lot of videos, for example, screencasts, we call them. We also using interviews with people. We also using screencasts where people are with filmed lectures. Google Maps features very heavily, but it's not just Google Maps. We put historical maps in to show change over time. We also created a tool where students can create their own kind of Google mashup by putting points on the map. They can make, say, a virtual walking tour where people can walk through a town and see the changes over time. So the students put points in and balloons pop up with text and images, right. Things like that. That's quite exciting. Students can do that by themselves.
What are the nature of some of the assignments in this course?
The nature of the assignments are, of course, the more traditional essay, but also things like a research diary, which they keep on a wiki. And the wiki is open to other students, so students can comment on one another's observations and thoughts. And we thought that's a really nice feature, because it's very individualistic if you're doing a master degree very often. Mm-hmm. And interaction, especially for people who are doing a distance learning course and don't see the people on a daily basis, it's really important that it's that open for support, but also for exchange of ideas. The other thing that we do with them is, for example, students have to make a PowerPoint presentation with a description with it. And you really think, well, that's quite mundane, but you really have to think very carefully about the structure of a PowerPoint presentation, the text that goes with it. So that's one of the other things we're doing. What we also ask them to do is to keep, well, that's optional, but to keep their own blog. To write about their research, to write about the things they come across, because for the future that's a really important scholarly dissemination tool. So if you don't teach them that now, they're probably not going to do it, and also to show them the value of it. So these are a few of the things that we're doing.
So it sounds like they're building up a whole repertoire of online skills.
Yes.
Through this course.
Yes.
So this course is being delivered in an online distance education model. How do you see this approach as different? How does it differ from a traditional classroom setting, and what are some of the advantages or disadvantages of this kind of approach to teaching?
Well, the advantage is that anyone, anywhere in the world can take it. So it's truly global.
Borderless.
Borderless. The second advantage is that it's very easy to change course material. Because you simply can drop in text and images, which makes it very up-to-date, mm-hmm. Really. Of course, you can rewrite your lectures, but who's doing that every year? Here, it's actually almost necessary to do that, because the online world is changing so rapidly. Students go off online and they find all kinds of more current stuff, and they start to ask questions. So you can immediately respond to that, or at the beginning of the year, if something happens, you can incorporate that. The other advantage is that the material available online is extremely rich. Mm-hmm. In the olden days, you only could send them to the library, and here you simply can say, well, here are some wonderful databases, off you go, find material that you can use for your coursework. The disadvantage is that you don't see the students, and that you can't
right.
communicate directly with them.
Right.
So students might feel very lonely. So it's very important that you're quite hands-on. If a student emails you, it's not a good idea to respond only 3 or 4 days later. Responding as quickly as possible
yeah.
is really important. The other thing that's important is that there are interactive things like video tutorials, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, in my opinion, that should be built in. So that students get a feeling they're part of a community. Yeah, and this research diary, I think, is part of that as well. So that you're creating a kind of community feeling. If you can't create that, but yeah, that's really personal observation
mm-hmm.
and feeling. If you can't create it, I think that students might fail, actually, because they feel left on their own. And so it's a distance learning course, I think, is more intensive in some respects than normal teaching. You have to be more hands-on.
Well, it sounds like it's a really interesting course, and hopefully you might write something up after the launch of the course and give some reflections on how it ended up. I'd encourage listeners to visit eh-resources.org and see all of the great things that Jan has put up online, and to subscribe to the Exploring Environmental History podcast. Jan, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Dan Cohen, Shekhar Krishnan, John Lutz, Jan Oosthuyk, and me, Sean Farage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast by writing a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow Nature's Past on Twitter at Nature's Past. If you have any ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, contact me through my website at seancarage.wordpress.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org. Follow Niche on Twitter at twitter.com/niche_Canada. Thanks for listening, and be sure to download our next episode.